Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. It is June 14th, and I am Lynn Alexander, and this is Project U Radio. And you know what? Unfortunately, I do apologize in advance because I'm pretty sick tonight, and I probably will deteriorate as the evening goes by. So I do apologize for that. I will try to minimize the germs. Tonight we actually have a special guest. I'll bring Paul Corman Roberts in, as I usually do. But we have Zarina Zabriskie tonight, and later on we also have a track by Roger Porter, and I'll let Paul talk a little bit about that when he gets on. But you know what, Zarina is just amazing to me. You know, she's just got such a bold, refreshing, you know, personality, and I mean, I just, you know, it's like one day she just, you know, it's like she came out of nowhere, and you know, I've just been sort of attracted to her work and her personality and just her performances, and you know, I'm very excited because we'll be seeing her in July in Oakland at a bunch of events. She'll be at Toxic Abatement, she'll be at Zyfez, she'll be at The Crawl, she'll be everywhere, and I'm looking forward to seeing her. I hope that I have Paul on this evening. I think that I do. Are you on? Okay, it's possible that I don't, and I apologize for that. Let's see. Paul, you know, actually, he's at the Grinder, I believe, a reading series, and so he will be calling in when he has an opportunity to do so. And when he does, I will definitely pick him up. So I'm just going to get going. I don't know. See, the way that it works, the switchboard works, is that we have, you know, the numbers come up, and I don't necessarily know who I'm picking up and why. But that said, I just picked up 415 and 505, so you can go ahead and say hello, and you know, we'll get going.
Hello.
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello.
Hello. I have, hello. Well, we have two people. I think, okay, is Zarina on?
One of them might be Zarina.
One of
calling
them
out of nowhere.
Welcome. And we have another caller, too. Like I said, I wasn't sure what number, you know, which number was which, so I just picked up everybody, so... You know, we always have a little bit of anarchy with these shows, and I do apologize.
We need to check in.
That was a good one, actually. It's a nice little slight there on Alexander.
What do you mean a nice little slight? I'm
yeah,
not sure
anarchy,
who I'm picking up.
You know, anarchy since the last two shows has been anarchy. And
no,
I
mean that I'm really bad at remembering phone numbers. So when I see them come up, I'm not sure who I'm picking up, and so
oh,
it's
okay.
You know, I feel bad. That's what I mean when I say there's a little bit of, you know, because you know, it's difficult to tell because you just see the numbers. You don't see, you know, who you're picking up. But I believe we have Frankie Metro on, and
yes.
We have Zarina on, so I'm glad about that. And I'm, you know, I was just apologizing for the fact that I am pretty sick tonight. I don't get sick very often, thankfully, but when I do,
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. I tend to sound pretty, you know, pretty nasal and terrible and worse as I talk. So I do apologize if I have
to
cough.
You sound good. You sound very sexy.
Thank
you. You know, like when you sing, there's certain vibration in the voice. So I think it's good on the radio.
Well, the vibration of some kind of summer flu. So
yes.
Sorry.
So and welcome, Frankie. I'm glad you called in, and I'm sorry I didn't realize. You know, usually you come in on Skype, so I wasn't sure.
Switching it up tonight, you know. I'm putting on my black tie and my suit and and calling in with my phone instead of Skype. So, you know, it's a formal affair.
Well, that's formal.
All right. Well, I'm not saying what I am wearing, and I'm not on Skype, so you would never know.
Oh, my goodness.
I came prepared. You know, I'm not a very radio person. There's something about the voice being detached from the body, and this is the only medium that I thought would make me nervous. I'm not nervous now, but potentially I can become nervous, so I'm just warning.
Just keep drinking. Just keep drinking.
I actually did. I just had a little drink now, so I think that always is helpful. So we'll see how it goes.
That's the best remedy I've found. I definitely think that's the way to go. I usually don't describe what I'm wearing because usually at this it's 11:30 Eastern time, and usually I'm wearing something like hideous, like flannel pajamas or so, you know, something like that at this hour. So I'm almost always doing pajama radio out here.
Well, we do need to say, you know, we're writers. We can make things up, you know.
Right. Actually, I'm wearing a really hot lingerie.
Negligee.
That's right. With fishnets and boots and wigs and
I have
my trunk of toys all scattered around. Well, we know you're wearing.
That's what I'm wearing.
Right.
That's what I'm wearing.
Right. And I'm still not saying what I'm wearing. So. We'll try, though.
Well, I think we'll find out. I think we'll try to get it out of you. I think I just picked up Paul. I hope I just picked up Paul. If he can go ahead and say hello. Paul Corman Roberts.
We were just on Telegraph Avenue. That's what you're always trying to do, is get picked up on Telegraph. That's an important thing.
You're on Telegraph right now. You're calling from Telegraph.
No, I was picked up off of Telegraph. Now I'm in a car racing down the highway.
Oh, you sound like you're calling from Russia. I can hardly hear you at all.
That's okay. You sound like you're calling from San Bruno. Hey, it's also very, very far away.
Yeah, I can lose the signal anytime, actually. If I go offline, it's not because I dislike anyone. It's just because we have a terrible signal here. So it's a struggle. I have to basically sit and not move at all, because anytime I move, I lose the signal. So I'm sitting here without moving, and I will just for as long as needed, just like
the
that.
The torturing you, putting you on this show. Thank you for sacrificing your bodily movement for our program.
I'm ready to sacrifice myself, in the name of literature.
You never know where Paul will call in from. That's one of the fun things about this show, is because, you know, he's always out somewhere. I believe tonight it was the Grinder, if I'm correct. And, you know, he's always somewhere. He's always at some kind of a meeting, some sort of a planning session, some sort of a, you know, he's always somewhere. So you never know where he'll be when he calls in, which sort of gives us this element of, you know, sort of, I don't know, a little bit of voyeurism into his daily schedule, I guess.
One time I called in from Hawaii.
Right. You've called in from all kinds of places. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. If you're driving, then you are breaking the law at this moment. Is that correct?
Okay, as I check my rearview mirrors and my side mirrors, yes, indeed, I am breaking the law. I'm in violation of state. I am in violation of California state law as I drive my car. With power steering, I might add. With power steering. And I am speaking on the phone at the same time. I'm a bad
example. No text message, you'll be okay.
Of a bad citizen.
Well, so
that's
we might have
nice.
The... Oh, I'm sorry, guys.
That was just my support in breaking the law, nothing else.
we might have the experience of Paul being pulled over again and get to listen live as he explains that he was, you know, not talking on the phone. We've sort of had that before, haven't we? Am I ratting you out here? No, but, I mean that sort of stands up as one of the funniest PCR moments that I can recall, because
obviously I'm gonna have to write about that one, assuming it doesn't get censored.
Well, and that's one of the things we wanted to talk about. You know, on this show, we talk a lot about censorship. We talk a lot about banning books, and I talk a lot about it. And I think as a group, one of the things that we really kind of rage against, especially at Literary Underground, Michelle McDonald, Citizens for Decent Literature. One of the reasons that she named it that is because it was actually an effort, a coordinated effort, to try to keep, you know, immoral and, you know, morally, you know, distasteful literature out of the hands of the citizens of the people here in the United States. And I mean, that censorship is a tradition that, you know, is not unique to the U.S. I mean, certainly, you know, other countries have had their own experience with the suppression of information. You know, one of the things that I wrote about this month at Red Fez was Judy Blume, because Judy Blume actually now it's the 70s, it's decades ago, but at the time it was pretty groundbreaking, because she wrote a book about teenagers that, you know, she had the audacity to write a book about teenagers having sex. And, you know, it was a huge uproar. I mean, you know, you couldn't get this book, and people hid it, and people passed it to one another. It was like the underground, you know, to try to read this book. And I mean, I think about, and at the time I thought about, like, how courageous that is, you know, knowing what that could have done to her career. And, so I see things like that as heroic. So one of the things, I mean, we have a lot of things to do tonight, but one of the things is to sort of talk about, you know, not just censorship and not just repression of literature, but also, you know, people, you know, how difficult it can be to sort of stand up to that. So I don't know if you guys have anything you want to add to that, or you just want to talk about your own thing. But that was sort of one of the things that I wanted to get into a little bit.
Zarina is our guest. I should allow her to go first. Although I do remember, in the most modern sense of the word, I mean, it doesn't seem like anything is censored in the United States of America, so long as the self-publishing industry really allows you to say any sort of twisted thing you want. I mean, what they called censorship in the 50s in America, you know, they would try to censor something like Judy Blume, who has to be, you know, given credit for, you know, crossing that line that needed to be crossed at that time in our culture. But I mean, but when we talk about censorship in America, it really is about a cultural line. Whereas Arena comes from a society where it was a matter of life and death. It was a matter of jail versus freedom, if that could be considered any kind of a freedom. So I can't compare. I mean, it seems like the United States in the early part of the, you know, 21st century, in the early aughts, seemed a very censored place, particularly around the subject of war, and particularly about, you know, the Middle East wars. But even then, you know, but people were able to stand up, and there were these few lone voices. And I don't know that you ever really got that in a place like the Soviet Union.
I think there are different definitions of censorship, basically, because, like, in America, they didn't ban Lolita. They banned it in France, right, in the 50s, but they were okay with it here. And in Russia, pretty much everything was banned, whatever was real. And it was really the matter of life and death. And it didn't feel as dramatic as it sounds. It was a part of everyday life. So basically, when I heard that you guys are doing the show about censorship, I thought, like, maybe I should talk about it a little bit, because I experienced it even as a child. You kind of grew up with the idea of double think. You knew to censor what you are saying and what you are showing from the very early age, like 5, 6. You knew that there are some books that you hide and there are some books that you show in the children's literature. And then, of course, as you grow up,
how did they seed doublethink into you? It sounds like it's something that they did to you as children, whereas, like, if you see or experience words in a certain way, you're taught to think, oh, then you need to think this when you experience, I don't know, this type of a communication. It seems very abstract and scary and concrete to me all at the same time.
Yeah, and part of it, you know, like, you know, the Orwell said, even to think about double think is already exercising the double think. So it's kind of hard to really explain it. But I'll give you some examples. I have tons of examples. My father taught me to read between lines. Most of the books that I read had information in between lines. Like, it always, the book, educational book, say, a textbook, always had to be started with a quote by Lenin or Marx or Engels. So the first paragraph would always contain a quote from one of those writers, and sometimes the quote from Brezhnev. I don't know if you remember who he was, but
I definitely remember Leonid. Yeah, I have a shot glass with his image on it.
Yeah. So we always had, even when I wrote an essay at the age of 10, I would quote Brezhnev or Lenin in the first paragraph. But then, if I were clever, I could go about anything I wanted to, even about Bulgakov, if I knew how to do it right. So in some ways, I was thinking about it today, I'm almost grateful for that, because I always see more to the text, because I'm trying to think what else is hidden there. I always assume there is something hidden in a book, and they're like multi-layered connotations, and sometimes they are not. So that's a huge disappointment. Anyway, and when I grew up a little bit, I knew that we had books on the bookshelf that had the covers that said names on them, and they were not true. So you had to take the book off the shelf, take off the sleeve, and say the sleeve would read Lenin, and inside there was Nabokov or Bulgakov or Burl or, I mean, anything from the world literature, Faulkner. And I would have to also lie to my parents, because they wouldn't want me to read their books, because they were afraid that I, at my young age, would tell to my friends and they would get in trouble. So I would
how would you find these books? How would you come across them?
On my parents' bookshelves and on my grandparents' bookshelves. I would
dig
in.
I see. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so you pull off the sleeve. You know not to believe the sleeve. You never believe the cover. You pull off the cover. Under the cover is not the book that you expect to be there. So you can imagine the issue of trust. I never trust anyone or anything that I see. I have to pull off the cover.
Right. I think that people here, especially, you know, younger generations here in the United States, I mean, I think that even just the idea of censorship. I mean, there's so much out there on the web, especially. I mean, it's almost like, I mean, anything is out there. It really is. And I think it's hard for people now, you know, this generation in particular, you know, growing up now, to imagine a time where it was, you know, it was so risky to write about certain subjects. And I think it's hard for people in the United States to imagine a situation where you had to fear for, you know, in many cases, your life because of what you were doing. And I hope I'm saying this right, but, you know, I've been interested in sort of in I think it's Samizdat, is that the self-published book?
Mm-hmm.
And I hope
mm-hmm.
I'm saying it correctly. I don't mean to butcher it, but,
yeah,
you know, sort of.
Right. Yeah.
Right, the, you know, kind of this public, this sort of underground publication of things. I mean, you know, there were people that, you know, got in pretty big trouble for trying to do that. And, you know, and I think that it also, it was film. I mean, it was everything was controlled, you know, at one time. And, I mean, I imagine just the culture of paranoia that, you know, people needed to grow up in. You know, you never, I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah, I can give you an example. Like when I was 16, we would basically copy type on a typewriter. We didn't have a computer then. I had a typewriter, and we would type poetry that we would borrow from one another, like Tsvetaeva or Pasternak or Mandelstam or the Russian poets who were not allowed. So we would borrow it from one another and retype it. And that was also a form of samizdat. And one time somebody played a prank joke on me because I had a manuscript that I just retyped. I think it was by Akhmatov or maybe it was Pasternak. I can't remember right now. And we were smoking pot, too, so we were especially paranoid. And then a friend of mine called me, and we didn't have cell phones, so they called me at home, and they said in a really low voice, you know, this is Colin, Ivanov calling, and we now came to the knowledge that you are in possession of this certain manuscript, and I believed it. I totally believed it. I was convinced that somebody is coming to my door to arrest me because they used to do those stuff. You know?
Right.
Sounds like you get more in trouble for the possession of the literary material than the illicit substances.
Oh, both. You could go to prison for both, but we were very sneaky too.
Right, but it just goes to show, though, the lengths that people, you know, I don't know that people, you know, now appreciate the lengths that people have had to go to get access, you know, to information, to, you know, just to be able to read the things that they want to read. I mean, people, you know, I think people can't relate to that, you know, because things now are so available. And if, you know, and you can self-publish and there's so much freedom. But I don't know that people really understand that there were, you know, these eras in you know, history where, I mean, you could die. I mean, you could be killed for something like that and just for spreading certain ideas. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine the courage that it would take to, you know, risk your life or risk going to prison just to read. I mean, it sort of gives you a new, I think, perspective on, you know, the importance of words and ideas that people have been willing to risk their lives for it. I mean, that's something.
In many ways, it was a defense mechanism. It was also an escape mechanism, both drugs and literature, because, you know, the reality was pretty grim. It was gray and oppressive, and we felt it. By the time, you know, I was in my teens, it was all falling apart, so we knew that it was no good. You sense it. As a kid, so the two ways to escape it is by reading good books and by doing drugs, so we did both, and it wasn't even a question whether we want to risk the life or it, because the other life wasn't really a life, you know. You can rot alive, or you can read good books and shoot heroin, and that was fun. So,
yeah.
And, I mean, I will regret it. I mean, in many ways, I think it was more exciting than things that I can go to, I don't know, Amazon or Barnes & Noble and buy anything I want. It's, you know, it lacked this excitement, but I had enough excitement. I'm fine with that.
You've had enough of it. It was risky. I mean, you know, there was an element of risk to it, which I'm sure is, you know, exciting too. But I mean, I think it's still very courageous and I think very brave of somebody to, you know, rebel in that way. Just, you know, like I said, just to be able to read the things that, you know, it's hard to imagine.
I think it was more courageous for grown-ups, because as a kid, you rebel as by nature. You don't really understand what you're doing, and you don't know the consequences. So I can't take the credit for that. But the grown-ups at the time who knew what they were risking, they were really, you know, I have admiration for them. Like, we were just stupid. We didn't know what we were doing. But actually, I found an interesting example when I was thinking about this. I don't know if you know, but here in America these days, like right now, they have the software on Android by Google's, you know, like mobile operating system or something that sends us bad words. You know, it's a built-in voice-to-text feature. So any words like fuck or shit, they will exchange for a number. So somebody did the research, and they also exchanged words like Lolita or Nabokov. They knew to exchange that. That was like an obscene word. Lolita was an obscene word for Android. I was like, wow, that's interesting too.
Right, Right. Well, you know, it's, I mean, you know, we, I mean, there are situations even today where, you know, there are librarians. I mean, you know, like when I was younger, I mean, certainly, I mean, I'm kind of saying my age a little bit here, but, you know, there were books, you know, certainly that were banned that you could not get out of the library. And there were a lot of librarians here over the years that have taken a stand against that. And not only that, but the releasing of the records of what people were checking out. I mean, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, there are people looking into what people are reading in the library. You know, it's a wonderful situation that we have now. I mean, it's not perfect. It's not completely free. I mean, there are attempts to restrict the freedom, you know, of everybody. But I think that we've come a long way. I think that, you know, I don't know that people would tolerate and stand for that kind of censorship, but you know, it still does happen. I mean, there are still libraries today where there are banned books. There are schools where books are banned, and you know, it's
there
you
are
know,
still
it's,
book burning. United States
yeah,
still has
sure.
book burning.
Sure, and I think one of the things, I mean, you can understand in context, you know, why an oppressive government, why a particular regime would be afraid of information, would be afraid of its citizens getting a hold of, you know, of ideas of, you know, that might maybe trigger, you know, rebellion or trigger, you know, a sense that maybe there are others out there that agree also. You know, you can understand that need for control, but sometimes I wonder just from a cultural point of view, you know, I mean, like I said, the example of this book about, you know, just, I mean, it was about teenage sex. It wasn't even like a big deal. And but actually it provided a lot of information, and a lot of us, you know, a lot of people I knew were pretty glad to have it because they would not have had the information any other way. They weren't getting it from their parents, they weren't getting it from school. You know, it was the only information
yeah.
they had, especially about, you know, birth control pills. And you know, I don't know, I think it's a sad situation, but you know,
smoking
I mean certainly
pot
you're
will not make you pregnant. just saying, I actually learned that tonight, that smoking pot will not make you pregnant. Although some people insist that it still does.
Right. Well, a lot of people would be having a lot more babies if you know.
Maybe because it affects their judgment. I don't know.
Right. And I mean, you know, and I hope, and one of the things I was hoping to do is, I mean, I don't know if you'd like to read anything of your own. I mean, certainly we're glad to have you on here and ask you things, and you know, anytime, you know, you want to be on. But I mean, I don't know if you're interested in reading something. I mean, really, it's your, you know, it's your time. You know, you can read something, or you know, if you want to do a poem or story or anything like that, just sort of, you know.
You know, I haven't written anything about on the subject, not yet, but a lot of other people did, and they're kind of really good. So I've got some things that I can read, and some are short and some are a little longer. So I don't know. There's a really, really cute, like, super flash piece by a Russian absurdist Harms, Daniel Harms. He had a pretty sad life. He wrote
when
in the 20s and 30s, and he was arrested and put to prison for his writing, and he died not just in prison, but he died of starvation in the city of Leningrad in prison. So that's like as bad as it gets for your writing. And so I had two short pieces by him, which pretty much covered the situation on censorship in Russia in the 30s. So
yeah,
I actually would like to
read
that.
That would be great. We're getting so tonight on our program, we're getting Russian literature from the 30s. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. His name is Daniel Harms, and he's Russian absurdist, surrealist. And I have two very short pieces. Mm-hmm. So I'll just go ahead and read the first one.
Sure.
And it's called The Blue Notebook Number 10. There once lived a red-headed man who had no eyes and no ears. He also had no hair, so he was called the redhead only figuratively. He couldn't speak, as he had no mouth. He also lacked a nose. He even lacked arms and legs, and he had no stomach, and he had no back, and no spine, and he had no kind of innards at all. He had nothing. So it's unclear what we are talking about. In fact, it's better that we say nothing more about him.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he's brilliant, and this is 30s for you. It's brilliant, and it's scary, because people disappeared like ghosts. You know, like the long black car would come at night, arrive at night in the yard, and those, you know, people, soldiers dressed in suits will march up, and next thing you know, the person is missing, and nobody still knows where they are. And so that's what happened to Harms. And, I mean, this is pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, and the less we say about that incident or those people, the better.
Yeah.
Right, I mean,
actually... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, if anyone is interested, you know, there's a publication, The New Absurdist, that actually has quite a bit about him and his life on their site, their pages, and it's a horrible story. I mean, what happened to
mm-hmm.
him? You know, just absolutely, you know, a horrible example, and you know, and such a, you know, just what a horrible way. You know, to go.
Yeah.
But he's hardly the only one. I mean, you can also look at the fate of perhaps it's one of the esteemed guests from our show who turned me on to the work of Evgeny Zamyatin, who is really one of the finest Russian poets ever. I would think
mm-hmm.
he certainly. Yeah, I certainly found him to be a brilliant poet. Because his novel We, which Zarina was so wonderfully generous to give me for my birthday, was this is the diary of a poet. This is the diary of a poet who is looking beyond where his country was. But I mean, he wrote. This is the first truly some people called We the first science fiction novel, which I don't agree with per se. I don't think it's the first science fiction novel, but I do believe it is the first. Hybrid of dystopian science fiction.
Yeah.
Right,
and then a couple
of guys further on down the line named Huxley and Orwell. You know,
mm-hmm.
got an awful lot of mileage out of that formula from that
mm-hmm.
particular author, who himself was actually. He himself actually lived through a genuine revolution and a cultural revolution, and even tried to fit into, you know, the cultural commissariat. I mean, you have to remember that the Soviet Union, when it began, was a real genuine experiment in social engineering, and that there were cultures and a lot of you know, and it was a bit of, you know, I think for a while it was a socialist nirvana, but of course there were cracks, and there was a cult of personality waiting to take over that particular movement, not just obviously in the Soviet Union, but also in National Socialist Germany and in Italy, and you can't discount the influence of a lot of the more, you know, Southern futurists in that contribution to that cult of personality, as it were. But still, I mean, you know, these guys wrote their hearts out and were exiled to Siberia or to the horrible work camps that they had, and it's a hell of a, this is a freedom in the United States that we have the convenience and the entitlement and the comfort to take advantage of, and we should do this. We should write. We should look at these guys, and we should be encouraging writing like what these guys wrote, because otherwise. You know, what is left but complacency within, you know, the ruling paradigm?
Yeah. No, it's actually very true. Like, I have a longer piece. I have a few pieces that I looked at that would be perfect to fit it into the theme, and one of them is by Kundera, and that you really nailed it, Paul, because he talks about the... You know, that the regimes were started by enthusiasts, not by criminals, and people
right.
who really believed in it. And I know it from my own family history. It's a story to be written. I know I will write it one day. I'm just not there yet. But my own grandfather he fell in love with Soviet, you know, Red Revolution at the age of 10. He became a young pioneer, and he fought for the Soviet power before the revolution, through the revolution, during the revolution, through the war, somehow survived the Stalinist era, was a big shot. And then actually his son saw the ridiculousness of the idea, and he became a dissident and left Soviet Union. And at this point, my grandfather was expelled from the party and was kicked out of his job that he had for many years. He was a head of a big plant, one of the biggest metal plant in Soviet Union. And he came home and he died of a heart attack. And I remember that. So it was like a Greek tragedy taking place in my house because of this generational fathers and sons conflict, ideological too, because the grandfather believed to his last moment, to his last breath, he believed in the idea somehow. I don't know how. He saw everything that happened, and he still believed in it. And when his son left for America, he just died, just like that.
It's so beautiful, and it's so tragic. And I mean, I think you get a real sense. I sense frequently, and I think the Russian people know their literature, and they have, you know, they're aware of the epic happening amongst them in everyday reality, because that's what our classics and our epics are about. When you break them down and look at them, you can find they really are about our everyday sort of existence, you know, and it's kind of what we live through, and it's sad because I think in the United States it gets created mostly as an inconvenience of economics and the number of commodities that have to be waded through in order to process, you know, the death, no loss. And I mean, I think there's I don't know, I treasure the sensibility to recognize the epic in the everyday life, and that's, I don't know, and maybe, and I don't know, I guess that's a cruel irony that something like an extreme state like the Soviet Union happened to so many brilliant creative people that way.
But, you know, like on the other hand, that's why we are so fucked up. We rely on literature to survive.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the only reason my uncle was able to recognize the stupidity of the communist idea wasn't from his father, who was a believer, a true believer to the end.
Sure.
He learned from all of this, from Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov and all the books that I still have on my bookshelf now. I'm looking at them now. So reading these books was the way to survive and stay sane. And in this country, you don't need, I mean, it's not that bad. It's okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, maybe I'm missing it, but, you know, I guess there's the establishment and consumerism that can eat you up, but at least it's not the ideology. You know what I mean? It's, although I don't watch television, so what do I know?
I think it's just tougher. I think it's just harder in a society when you have access to so much. And, you know, there is a lot of access even to a lot of dissonant and different and even, like, really repulsive ideas that are available. And so, such freedom to that access, it's hard because that kind of material loses its meaning with that type of access. I think when there's repression, it's harder and it means a little bit more. And I think our challenge is to make our literature mean something. You know, that I think it. Where is it? Where is the way in which that our, not just our literature, but our art in general, is able to allow us to, you know, escape this sort of feeling of you know, kind of a, I don't know, just a mediocre declining empire, really, you know, which feels like it's like this horrible hangover. And really, make no mistake about it, I think it's an echo of what the British went through in the 60s and 70s, realizing that they were an empire on the decline. There's not a great future for, you know, the traditional role models that you used to have in a system like that.
Can I ask a question that I'm dying to ask it, and I hate asking it because I know that it puts you on the spot Zarina, and I hate doing that, but it's like I have to ask you because we've had shows where we've talked about socialism, where we've talked about anarchy, and I don't want to get political because we are we're talking about sort of specifically literature. However, I think that there are people that have almost like a glamorized sense of what a communist state-run regime actually looks like in practice. I think there are a lot of people who think, oh, it's collectivist. It's everybody sharing and cooperative. And I don't know that people realize that in a lot of cases to enforce the, quote, collective will, that you actually have sort of an elite group of people that are quite oppressive and quite abusive of the population, that it's not necessarily, this sort of glorified idea of, the will of and good of the people being represented by the government. I don't know, do you find that people, when you hear people now say, oh, you know what, communism is the way to go, it's the way to, for fairness, for justice, for the people to have power. I mean, do you find that the people had power in that particular regime?
Well, Stalin definitely had powers. No, I mean, I didn't have that many experiences where people would be so naive, I have to say, because this idea just doesn't work coming from where I come from. We never really actually built communists because I think this is a goal not achievable. But we did build some kind of lame socialism, and it was really bad. It really didn't work, not economically, not ideologically, not in any sense. It was completely dysfunctional society, where the only advantage I think was the culture thrived because the underground culture thrived because that was the only way to oppose the regime. But no, people had no power. We had no we didn't have very much. Which is okay. I'm not very materialistic myself, and I'm not complaining about my living condition. They were okay. We had running water. We had certain things. We didn't have food, but I'm not big on eating anyway. But we didn't have freedom, That's what bothered me the most. You couldn't say what you wanted. You couldn't think what you wanted. Actually, I was thinking about telling you that anyway. My first proactive encounter with the censorship was when I was probably 13, and I had this momentarily aspiration to become an artist, and me and my friend, who did become an artist later, we painted a newspaper, like a newsletter, to put on a billboard, and it's just like a postcard. It was a smile. It was nothing but a smile, just a mouse, like big red mouse smiling on a black background. And we were really happy with the way it came out, and we put it on, and it was removed within the next 2 hours because it was too suggestive and it was anti-communist. And that was the level of oppression. The kids couldn't draw a smile. That gives you some idea of the freedom that we did have. We always had to lie. On the material level, you could never get any clothes. Everybody wore the same, or you had to sew some clothes. And I don't know what power were there, if not for reading the books that were on your parents' bookshelves and they were hidden. Socialism or communism really, in my system, didn't work out for the humankind. That's my personal verdict.
Right. Right.
Was that real Marxism, or was that really just a perversion of something that, that an old German Jew wrote in a book a long time ago? And there's a whole dichotomy of socialism. I mean, there was the ideal developed by the Soviet Union, but you do see the Scandinavians producing or practicing a form of democratic socialism, which at least seems a little bit more functional. You know, it's not...
Right, but I'm not talking about that, Paul. I mean, I understand that there are models of socialism. However, I'm just saying that there are people right now who will say that, you know, communism is the model that truly reflects cooperative and collective interest. And I'm just sort of thinking, I don't know, when I look at examples of where people have tried that, it seems to me that to keep the public in order and to, you know, impose the will, you know, of what, I mean, supposedly is what's best for you, you know, you have to be extremely oppressive and extremely threatening and a very overbearing government. You know, it's also interesting when people tell me, oh, well, I believe in anarchist communists. And I think, well, that's kind of, you know, you sort of have, it just seems at odds to me. I'm not saying that, you know, hey, it can happen. I mean, you can, you know, but it just, you know, and like I said, I didn't mean to sort of derail it politically. I just, you know, I listen to the experience of what people, you know, have gone through, you know, and just the level of control and this really extremely oppressive kind of a state where, you know, the citizens aren't free to do anything, even read on their own. And I don't know. I'm sorry. I understand that what you're saying is sort of it was sort of a bastardization of a lot of these ideas. However, you know, it seems like it's doomed to become bastardized. You know, I don't know.
I mean, it's the human nature. This theory doesn't take in consideration human psychology, because these people, they never ventured to explore psychology. If they looked around, you know, Freud was around at the same time. They should have just read a little bit. This whole idea of, you know, being equal and dividing everything into parts. You know, if anybody kids in the kindergarten would know that it's that they were absurdists, if you want to know, in my view. They were the best absurdists ever, Marx, Engels, and Lenin, and all those guys. It's absurd.
Freud's a whole other show.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think to a certain extent, a lot of human nature is a desire, you know, for some individualism. And I think that, you know, a system where individualism is permitted and encouraged, you know, is, you know, in many cases, a society where everybody, you know, is better off. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I don't want to get into kind of, you know, a debate about that. I just was curious because it's a unique opportunity to ask somebody that question who, you know, has seen it and has lived it and has, stories to tell about it, you know. Because from your end, living it.
Examples, you know, we had to march whether we wanted or not. You know, like on 7th of November, we had to march out of that warm house and march down the cold street to a certain tune that we didn't choose in a certain tempo that we didn't choose. And then, you know, when we were a little older, we were marched around to go to the collective farmhouse for months to sit in a wet field to dig the carrots out of the ground. And that was for the students of the literature. We had to,
sounds awesome.
There was no way out of it. You know, it's not like you could volunteer with some kind of a kibbutz. You either do it or you're fucked. You get out of the university and you don't get your education. And then, you sing certain songs that glorify Lenin and the party. And, I mean, all these glorified little legends and myths about the communism, this is a little disinformed, you know, but I'm very apolitical as a result. You know, I don't go into politics ever for a good reason, too.
Right.
Funny, it sounded like you were talking about Sunday school for a second. I was just getting kind of lost in that, there seems to be a lot of... It's secularized, but it seems to have the ritual. You know, the ritual smacks of religion to me. It smacks of
control,
institutionalized, organized
I think
religion.
the common thread there is control, whether it's control by a church, control by an institution, or control by the state. That's why when you say, oh, you know, they bring in the anarchy thing, I don't know, I have a little trouble with that, because, you know, the commonality is control, intellectual control, you know, control of the arts, control of behavior. I mean, it's just, you know, it's hard to imagine, honestly. It's hard to imagine. But you could see why, you know, I remember people saying, well, why didn't people, you know, kind of rise up and complain? Well, you know, you can see why they didn't, because, you know, look at what happened to you. You know, look at what happened to you if you read the wrong book. I mean, you know, talk about, you know, the
I had friends who went to prison, you know. Well, fairness, most of my friends went to prison for owning the shooting heroin, not for owning the books. But some of them got in trouble for owning the wrong books. So, I mean, yeah, you couldn't. I mean, there's always an idea, why didn't anybody shoot? Why didn't anybody stand up and say, well, you guys committed, you're wrong? There was an opportunity to do that. We had underground concerts and, you know, like readings in apartments where you had to hide. Otherwise, you go to prison and it should not do it. I mean, then nobody would know about it. It's pretty hard to write this.
And of course, you have to remember, eventually it did. People did stand up. There was, I mean, it was overthrown, you know. It does
eventually.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it kind of fell apart, Paul. Nobody really, I mean, it's there.
Right,
I
right.
Mean,
yeah. That's a really good point.
Right.
No,
I mean,
there was no appraisal at my time, and nobody came to anywhere with guns or anything like this. It just fell apart because it wasn't sustainable anymore. It was just so bad that it basically rotten inside out. And I remember
and
this coup in...
And then afterwards, the capitalists came in, and then there were guns.
Well...
I don't know how it would be. It was supposed to be a sense show, not just a Russia show, because I think censorship is a more interesting topic than a Russia.
Right.
Everybody knows that Russia is fucked up.
Right. And you wanted to read something else, right? Because I don't want to... Well, you don't have to.
I had a piece in mind. It's kind of the longer side. It's a piece from Kundera, who actually is a big Russian hater. He's a, you know, Czech. But he has in there one of my favorite books, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which I love that book dearly. And it has pretty much anything on anything. And, of course, it has something on censorship. And it's a pretty good explanation on how it worked. Actually, the answer to a question, why couldn't you resist it? But it takes about 10 to 12 minutes. I can read it if there is interest, or we can just talk.
Right. No, that's fine. I mean, it probably would bring us into the archives, which I think is fine. So, you know, most of the people that listen do listen in archives, so they can, you know, certainly catch the rest of it that way. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think you should read it if you don't mind.
Yeah, I mean, I always would love to read some Kundera. Hey, I could read the whole book. So I read this piece. When Russians invaded Czechs, Tomáš, the male protagonist of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, who is a brilliant surgeon, he got in a little trouble with the regime there. So here we go. I will cut through the chapter because it's too long, but it gives you an idea. Anyone who thinks that the communist regimes of Central Europe are exclusively the work of criminals is overlooking a basic truth. The criminal regimes were made not by criminals, but by enthusiasts convinced they had discovered the only road to paradise. They defended that road so valiantly that they were forced to execute many people. Later, it became clear that there was no paradise, that the enthusiasts were there for murderers. Then, Everyone took to shouting at the communists, "You are the ones responsible for our country's misfortunes. It had grown poor and desolate. For its loss of independence, it had fallen into the hands of the Russians, for its judicial murderers." And the accused responded, "We didn't know. We were deceived. We were true believers. Deep in our hearts, we are innocent." It was in this connection that Tomas recalled the tale of Oedipus. Oedipus did not know he was sleeping with his own mother, yet when he realized what had happened, he did not feel innocent. Unable to stand the sight of the misfortunes he had wrought by not knowing, he put out his eyes and wandered blind away from Thebes. When Tomas heard communists shouting in defense of their inner purity, he said to himself, "As a result of your not knowing, this country has lost its freedom, lost it for centuries perhaps, and you shout that you feel no guilt? How can you stand the sight of what you've done? How is it you aren't horrified? Have you no eyes to see? If you had eyes, you would have to put them out and wander away from Thebes." The analogy so pleased him that he often used it in conversations with friends, and his formulation grew increasingly precise and elegant. So he sat down one day, wrote down his reflections on Oedipus, and sent them to the Czech Writers Weekly. A month later, he received an answer, an invitation to the editorial offices. The editor who greeted him suggested that Tomas should change the word order in one of the sentences, and soon the text made its appearance. On the next to the last page, in the letters to the editor section. 2 or 3 months later, the Russians decided that free speech was inadmissible in the gubernia of Czech Republic, and in a single night, they occupied Tomas' country with their army. Tomas, one day, was called by the chief surgeon into the main office of the hospital. "You know as well as I do," said the chief surgeon, "that you're no writer or journalist or savior of the nation. You're a doctor and a scientist. I'd be very sad to lose you, and I'll do everything I can to keep you here. But you've got to retract that article you wrote about Oedipus. Is it terribly important to you?" "To tell you the truth," said Tomas, recalling how they had amputated a good third of the text, "it could be any less important." "You know what's at stake," said the chief surgeon. Tomas knew all right. There were two things in the balance. His honor, which consisted in his refusing to retract what he had said, and what he had come to call the meaning of his life, his work in medicine and research. "Oh, by the way," the chief surgeon added, "you won't have to make a public statement. I have the assurance. Authorities, they're bureaucrats. All they need is a note in their files to the effect that you have nothing against the regime. Then if someone comes and attacks them for letting you work at the hospital, they are covered. They've given me their word that anything you say will remain between you and them. They have no intention of publishing a word of it." Tomas was considered to be the best surgeon in the hospital. Rumor had it that the chief surgeon, who was getting on towards retirement age, would soon ask him to take over. When the rumor was supplemented by the rumor that the authorities had requested a statement of self-criticism from him, no one doubted he would comply. Then one day, Dr. S., a talented young physician, asked Tomas, "Well, have you written it up for them?" "What in the world are you talking about?" Tomas asked in return. "Why, your retraction," said Dr. S. There was no malice in his voice. He even smiled, one more smile from that thick herbal of smiles, the smile of smug moral superiority. "Tell me, what do you know about my retraction?" said Tomas. "Have you read it?" "No," said Dr. S. Then what are you babbling about? Still smug, still smiling, Dr. S replied, look, we know how it goes. You incorporated into a letter to the chief surgeon or to some minister or somebody, and he promises it won't leak out and humiliate the author. Isn't that right? Tomas shrugged his shoulders and let Dr. S go on. But even this, even after the statement is safely filed away, the author knows that it can be made public at any moment. So, from then on, the author doesn't open his mouth, never criticizes a thing, never makes the slightest protest. The first peep out of him and into print it goes, sullying his good name far and wide. On the whole, it's rather a nice method. One could imagine worse. Yes, it's a very nice method, said Tomas. But would you mind telling me who gave you the idea I'd agreed to go along with it? Dr. S shrugged, but the smile did not disappear from his face. And suddenly, Tomas grasped a strange fact. Everyone was smiling at him. Everyone wanted him to write the retraction. It would make everyone happy. The people with the type of reaction who always did something wrong or signed the retraction themselves would be happy, because by inflating cowardice, he would make their actions seem commonplace and thereby give them back their lost honor. The people who had come to consider their honor a special privilege never to be yielded nurtured a secret love for the cowards, for without them, their courage would soon erode into a trivial, monotonous grind admired by no one. Tomas could not bear the smiles. He went to the chief surgeon and told him he would not write a word. The chief surgeon shook his hand with greater energy than usual and said that he had anticipated Tomas's decision. Perhaps he can find a way to keep it on even without a statement, said Tomas, trying to hint that a threat by all his colleagues to resign upon his dismissal would suffice. But his colleagues never dreamed of threatening to resign, and so before long, the chief surgeon shook his hand even more energetically than the previous time. It was black and blue for days. He was forced to leave the hospital. How are we doing on time?
We're okay. We are in the archives, but that's okay. You can
keep rolling.
You can do your thing.
So basically, I mean, it goes on. The sad story goes on. I won't read the whole thing, but Tomas then starts working at the provincial hospital, the very second-rate hospital in a small village, and even then he's not left alone. And a representative from the Ministry of the Interior comes in and invites him to have a drink with him. And then he interrogates him, trying to get the names out, who was the editor of the magazine, and asks him to sign another petition and another confession. And in that confession, things are much worse. It didn't stop at the retraction of the Oedipus article. It contained words of love for the Soviet Union, vows of fidelity for the Communist Party, condemned the intelligentsia, which wanted to push the country into civil war, and above all, denounced the editors of the Writers' Weekly. And Tomas refuses to sign that as well. So as a result, he has to resign as a doctor, and he becomes a window washer. And that was the fate of many intellectuals and people who tried to resist. There were a lot of PhD janitors and basically janitors, and there was a profession called the, I don't even have this here, there's the big ovens, the operators of the ovens. They don't have ovens here. So the people who would throw coal into the oven in the yards. And that's why you couldn't resist very much. That's a very good representation of what used to happen.
It sounds like the fate of a lot of American academic intellectuals in the modern American economy. getting PhDs applying for jobs at convenience stores and whatnot.
Probably, but maybe for different reasons. I actually wouldn't know that. I would learn more about that.
I don't know.
Well,
I don't know what
that
you
is,
mean
that
there,
is,
but.
That is a phenomenon happening across our country over the last 3 to 4 years, so, and some would say even longer than that. And part of that is because it's, well, in any case, you're right. It's a completely different dynamic. I find it interesting that the end result is essentially the same.
You mean like when people are overqualified?
You know, there's only so much that knowledge serves. There's only, you know, genius only has so much value. In a society that's short on resources and short on infrastructure.
I don't think. Yeah, but see, I don't. You know, I don't want to go on a tear, but I don't think that we're short on resources. I think we're short on priorities, and I think that, you know, it's the product of opportunity. You either create opportunities, you know, for people to teach, and you either value education and culture and or you don't, and our society happens not to, and so as a result, there are a lot of PhD candidates and people with PhDs that are don't have jobs because there's no role for them to play. But I don't know that it's lack of resources. I think it's misappropriated resources. But I think that's a different situation, though, I think, than what we're talking about here. I think it was interesting for you to read that. I mean, I think that both pieces, because I think that you did do a good job of illustrating, you know, and in talking about, you know, the circumstances of the writers too, you know, the context for their writing, you know, is very important. I appreciate that, you know, you're reading and for, you know, and really just for kind of talking honestly and kind of off the cuff about things. I mean, you know, it's not easy to, get onto these shows and, you know, you don't know what we'll ask you. So, you know, you were pretty, you know, pretty good with us. And we do appreciate that because I I'm sorry, I do apologize because I did ask a political question and I wasn't planning to do that. Like I said, I just sort of, you know, I couldn't help it, you know, because
that's
given
fine.
What you were talking
that's
about,
fine.
You know, I kind of, it sort of got the wheels spinning, because I think a lot of times people reduce political movements into slogans, you know, a lot of times in fashion and trends, and they don't really think about what, you know, people that lived it, what the experience of it, you know, can look like, you know. So I think you did a very good job in this show of talking about that, censorship just being one of them, you know. I mean, obviously an oppressive, you know, society is, you know, all aspects, but, you know, certainly control of information and your, you know, access is, pretty horrible.
You know, like, if I were back in Russia, like, when I was growing up, and we were having this conversation, I would be paranoid and thinking that there is another party, you know, you and Paul and Frankie and me, and then there would be this lieutenant, the comrade lieutenant, who would be listening and recording everything that we are saying. And here I don't have this feeling, so it's wonderful.
But the thing is that I always say is people always say, you know, why are you always on this kick about censorship and banned books and, you know, you're always going on about that. You know, one of the things is that freedom and achieving a certain amount of freedom in a society, people don't realize how easily, when you're not vigilant and you're not looking out for these things, how you can, you know, backslide, and how, you know, in very subtle ways you can sort of move back in the direction that you came from. You know, there are people now that would absolutely rip a lot of books out of your hands and limit your ability to read them. And you have to know that those people are still out there. You know, the threat of censorship, as much as we enjoy our intellectual freedom, the threat of censorship is still out there, and it's still a real threat, and it's still something, I think, to think about. So, you know, that's the reason that I guess I go off a little bit on, my concern about it, because I think it's still very real, you know.
I
don't know. Yeah, so that's
I
because
understand.
I think,
I support.
You know, Yeah, because, you know, I mean, and we see this with all kinds of freedoms, you know, they're hard won, and they're so easily lost if you take them for granted as being a victory, you know, that's mm-hmm. established, that can't be taken back, because mm-hmm. it can be taken away from you. You know, we can go back to.
We were close to it. I'm telling you, right after 9/11, we were very close to that kind of mentality with a lot of people in this country. There was that moment. You had people who were like, well, all too willing to, you know, rat out their neighbors and have everybody be bugged for the greater good. You know, that was
right. That's,
you know,
that's what I mean.
A lot of people played to that fear. You know, that it wasn't. We weren't that far away from it. And you had a certain regime in power who was like, we're not necessarily against that.
Rationalize.
You hope cooler heads prevail. And maybe cooler heads have prevailed, but, you know, you got to realize you're never very far away from that.
And it's a slippery slope. It really is a slippery slope, because I think that the rationalizations and the way that control and the loss of your rights and freedoms are packaged and sold to the American people is very compelling, because, you know, it really does use the politics of fear and you know, and preying on people's fear over safety, you know, to convince you that this is something that is being done for your own good. And, you know, that's sort of the theme that I see, you know, that, you know, whether it's banning a book or whether it's censoring, you know, it's still the same message. It's somebody else telling you what is best mm-hmm. for your own good, you know, and that's mm-hmm. what I have a problem with. I personally don't want anybody deciding for me what's best for me or my family or my neighborhood or my city. You know, I really, the less people are able to do that, the better, because I do think it is a slippery slope with control. And, you know, I think that's their inroad. So it does concern me. It does. So, you know,
We still value individual freedom. We have to find better. I do think we have to find better ways to build communities and to build better communitarians. But at the end of the day, if you're being robbed of your individual rights, something's rotten in Denmark.
Right. And the pushing back. I think you have to push back on that. I think you do. I think you have to when you are being controlled and you are, you know, I think you have to push back just for the sake of pushing back, just for the sake of saying no. Mm-hmm. I'll say what I have to say, because the more people do that, you know, it minimizes the threat, it minimizes the buy-in of that control, and I think it's important to do that. So, you know, I mean, I am glad that you called, and I'm sorry that we sort of kept you over time. You know, I would keep you longer if I could, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in July. I think it'll be, you know, it'll be a week of a lot of events and busy things going on, but I hope that it's also a time that we can, you know, maybe, you know, go in the corner a little bit and, you know, have a little bit of quiet, you know, talking and getting to know each other out there, because, you know, it is also about community. You know, I can't emphasize that enough, that, you know, it isn't just to get up on a stage and, you know, show our feathers. I mean, you know, it really is and was meant to be from the start, you know, a bunch of events put together to really, you know, really, really get to know one another, you know, meet different people, you know, meet people in person, because it's such a different experience than online. And, you know, as much as you can talk to somebody, it's not the same as when you're in a room face to face. So the more we can do that when we're out there, I think, you know, the better. So I'm looking forward to it.
I agree. I think there's an awesome vibe that I feel that is, you know, all over Bay Area, and I think in the beginning of July, that should be awesome. There will be a lot of excitement going on. I'm pretty thrilled.
Right.
Yep,
so
Oakland is the fifth most popular destination in the New York Times travel section, so, you know, you're all helping do your part for that. Thank you so much. The city that I live in, thank you very much for all of your hard work and your contribution to, you know, what's a very big deal to us.
It is. It means they'll jack up all the prices of all the hotels. You just raised the price of beer in Oakland by writing that.
Good beer. It's really good beer, let me tell you.
So if it's okay, maybe we'll let, I don't know, who would like the last word, and we'll finish up here. Is that okay?
I'll just say thank you to both of you for, I think, one of the best shows we've ever had. I think to hear Daniel Harms read on our show to me is right now the highlight of the whole Project U Literary Underground experience. So a big thank you to you, a big thank you to Zarina for sharing just the raw truth and the raw stories. And I love it. That's such a level of genuine that you just don't get every day. And I have a really, really deep appreciation for it. And thanking you, Lynn, thank you so much for, you know, helping to get it to happen. And thank you to Frankie. Thank both of you for being these great producers of this great show that allowed this to happen and just really made me a happy, happy guy tonight, on top of all the other great stuff that's happening. We had such a great reading at the Grinder tonight. It was so nice. I have to go to my show. I have to go to my radio show. And I'm so glad I came to my radio show tonight. This is a very magical night for me. And both of you are a huge part of it. So there you go. I'm done gushing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I love everything on the ground. The ground is the best. So thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
I know you are.
Thank you.
I know you are. It's going to be a good time in July.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess I will end it. It is June. It's now June 15th on the East Coast, and that was Project U Radio. And I am going to say good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Good night, artists. Good night, wonderful, beautiful artists. Good night.
Thank you.